Welcome back, team, to episode 2. Just quickly going to cover off on episode 1 with Troy from Pain to Performance. Great podcast, an absolute even better bloke. Troy's a really good friend. Known him now, been working alongside him as a partner, referring on to Troy for over a year now, and I cannot explain the amount of information that I've learned from him, from his professional knowledge, is amazing. Absolutely great guy, always happy to help out, always happy to pass on information, has some really big names under his belt. So people like Jeff Horn, who we all know as the boxer, famous Australian boxer, among a plethora of other athletes. So it's just good and reassuring to know that such a high caliber person within Troy's profession is still able to express that through his athletes, and they keep coming back as well. So you can accredit some of their success to his professional input into their training. So be that manipulation and recovery and all of that, everything that encompasses myotherapy. Really, really good listen, guys. If you don't know what myotherapy is, I highly recommend you go back and listen. Troy will explain that. The best way I can explain it and really dumb it down is they are the new age cross between a physio and a chiro. So they're someone that can prescribe rehabilitation programs. They can also manipulate muscles, but they're also able to manipulate the spine and other parts of the skeleton. So it's like going and seeing a physio and a chiro all in one. The good thing with Troy is he has such a rounded knowledge and in-depth knowledge of fitness and the body and how sport performance and the body performing at a good rate is so important. So having someone that specializes within that is really important as well. It's not just, you know, if I've hurt myself in the gym, I'm going down to see just the physio down the road who may only look after old people, so they're not always dealing with those type of injuries or whatever it might be. So Troy is the best person to go see, and I know just from his workshops that he's done at our gym, we have improved so much, not only from the trainers and staff, but also all of the members. Everyone who's gone to see him, they know exactly what to do, and when they do it, when they actually do what Troy says, they see massive, massive results. So it's really good to see that. It's a great listen, guys, hearing how Troy came up from being a young fella, how he got into myotherapy as well is quite good. It's a good story, guys. And then how he's been dealing with everything that's going on through business before, so pre-COVID, so before March, and during, so where we're currently at now. So highly recommend going back and having a listen to that. Today, we have Ben and Dalt on, so very good friends of the show. Good to have them back. They are also going over things that have happened pre-COVID and post. So highly recommend having a listen to that. And some very exciting news, Dalt has just started up his new business. So highly recommend going, having a listen to this, guys. You're going to love it. And of course, guys, we've still got season 1. So if you haven't listened to any of that stuff, highly recommend going back and having a great listen to season 1. You're going to pick out some absolute gold nuggets in every single episode. But for now, guys, we'll kick off episode 2, Ben and Dalt. Hope you enjoy it, team. Let us know on the socials. Welcome, team. My name is Josh Atkins, and you're listening to Australia's Most Adventurous Podcast. Boys, welcome. Season 2. Good to have you in.
Thanks for having us, mate.
Cheers.
So, let's get straight into it. Dalt, you're starting up a new business, which is very exciting. So, we'll run through that first, which will then also segue into the past 6 months, I guess it's been.
Yeah.
6 to 8 months since last year, and we'll run up into what's happening and everything there. So, yeah, we'll kick it off, Dalt.
So I started starting to do my own business now. I've left Flex, starting and stepping up and doing my own thing. You can find my stuff at daltonfrank.com. My Instagram hasn't changed, so you can just always look that up at Dalton Frank. And I'm just looking to explore and build on everything that I kind of took away from there and expand upon new areas into the industry. I think that there's a lot of holes that I'm finding in the industry, and especially around behavioral change, coaching application, and overall like expectations and standards that people kind of get out of coaching services. So I figured, you know, why not start pushing my own interests and really redirect or reframe how everyone addresses coaching, like what they take away from coaching. Like I was talking about Ben with this a while ago, that we're kind of sick and seeing this old model of just coaches saying, do this food and follow this training program, and kind of it just being like a one-way street. And we kind of, everyone should be really expecting this new standard, this at least a two-way communication, some negotiation across it, some understanding of how to incorporate behavior change, and then continual back and forth support, as opposed to this like third party figure that kind of just stands from the sidelines and tells you what to do from afar, which is kind of what the industry's come to expect from most people. They just pay these ridiculous prices for coaching stuff, and it just comes down to like the lowest quality service that you could expect out of someone for something that you pay. So I've decided to flip the script and go, fuck that, I'm going to push for my own, set the bar high and really run that.
Perfect. So it sounds like that you're essentially eliminating any sort of thought that could be on, this is just the cookie cutter approach.
Yeah.
Which, you know, a lot of 100%. Those big people are definitely doing. Yeah. It's like, I've got this great program that worked for these 10 people. Here's mm-hmm. all the photos. Mm-hmm. So it's going to work for the masses. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that encompasses it perfectly. But what I don't want coaches to think is to like also that I'm completely against like creating templates and creating like a sustainable outcome or something like that through like a skeleton or something like that. Whilst there's complete individualization that goes on with clients and how I approach them, understanding where they're at both nutritionally, psychologically, training education or training age, taking all that into consideration to build something, and like deep diving into where that is, not just these vague overarching questions that people ask, like what are your goals, and someone says to tone up, and they're like, cool, and that's it. There's like the end of the conversation finishes there, and it's like, cool. Whilst that's like, that's helpful, that's just this crappy standard that we've had before. So across the industry, and you see it all the time with clients approaching me, and I'm like, why do you want to lose like that weight? And like, maybe just asking the why really helps to outline what their motivations are and stuff. And sometimes you realize that clients have like crappy motivations. It's just not going to sustain them. So I'm trying to take that whole individualization that I was doing with nutrition and training, reapply it, and utilizing overarching psychological principles to navigate the like outcomes that people want to have, right? Essentially, people come to me asking for weight loss, but I want to lead with education and like a complete change in their behavioral and psychology or point of views.
Cool. And one thing I've found really interesting, and I don't know, I'm assuming that it would help as well, just from watching your stories and stuff, is the stuff you were doing last year at uni.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't think you posted too much from the start of this year, did you?
It's been fucking hectic.
Yeah. Yeah. But run us through some of the stuff you were doing last year, like with all those tests and stuff. Were you doing something with food as well? There was like a...
Oh, so like the food science lab
and stuff like that.
So yeah, I was doing a lot of that, where we'd look into the food industry and see how they structure and process and manufacture foods, and how you can test sensory approaches or test people's reactions or thoughts to products and the end user. So it's kind of this new area in food, which is only new by about 20 years, but compared to engineering, which has been around for thousands, you know, it's got nothing behind it. So a lot of it is just really catching up really fast, but we're doing a whole bunch in like blind testing, like manipulating of like taste receptors and stuff like that to see how we can influence that, or change of ingredients, change of percentage of ingredients. So it was really getting behind the scenes and seeing how that works, to know just what it takes for like someone like Kraft or you know, Big or something like that to come up with a slight change in their like fat percentage or something like that, why they've done it, you know, continually using like consumer groups and stuff like that to like, yeah, behind the scenes what that actual change meant. You know, it could be something up the production line, like their field, like the peanut fields and stuff got like set on fire, and so they lost half the crop, so they've got to figure out ways to make it more palatable through adding or taking out other ingredients. Or if someone stuffs up halfway through the manufacturing and dumps the wrong amounts of stuff in, what you can do to dilute that down, that product down, to retain it, or what you would have to do to increase the percentages or characteristics and traits of other ingredients so that you can balance it back out to what the consumer has come to know for what their product is meant to taste like, right? So we did a whole bunch around that. And now into this year, I'm doing the same thing, but I'm doing it in a food production and safety aspect. So it's more like, what does from field to your plate look like, and how much of that is, like waste, or how much is like sent off to different productions, where the supply chains and stuff locally, and where they are internationally. Like awesome fun facts that I liked was the general 12 to 23 items that people purchase every week or every fortnight travel almost 80,000 kilometers to get to our plate. When you could look at trying to source it locally, you could drop it down to like 450 Ks if we were just a little bit smarter about how we did that. So the carbon footprint of those, the implication of that, then also like the implications of like how Australia is to be a farmland. It's pretty much a desert, so that sucks for the farmers, which makes our costs go up.
Yep.
But we also have some of the highest food standards in the world. So to get from locally grown to on the shelves as an Australian product is like, it's our exports of those products is just so high because it's such an insane standard. So learning about all that, doing a bunch of stuff in that. And then I'm also currently, my other subjects are like around nutritional diseases and how those, like the special populations and stuff, not necessarily, gen pop and whatnot, but more like diabetes or like gastrointestinal diseases and stuff. So yeah, been doing a bunch around that.
Cool.
Yeah, it's awesome.
And Benny, with everything that you started up with uni, so you started second semester last year?
Yeah, so it would have been just after our second podcast.
We started
at QUT. Originally it was started as a dual degree in business psychology. I really did have an interest in numbers and business and stuff, especially with managing store and managing work and things like that. But once I got started, sort of realized how much psychology and philosophy clicked in my head. There's not too many things that I've experienced, done, or looked into that actual study interests me or was able to retain or trigger further learning. Mm-hmm. And once I just started, I couldn't put the books down. I couldn't stop wanting to find more stuff to learn. I was going ahead of the class and finding more things to talk about. Me and Dalt could just have conversations on crazy levels of just random psychological or philosophy-based stuff.
For context, I studied second and third year psychology alongside of this, so yeah.
It makes me reaffirming the way I learn, reteaching or rediscussing principles that I have studied or looked into. It makes it easier for me to retain the information if I can find someone above me or in the same sort of area and I can reiterate that point. So I just found that I had spare time. What I am doing wasn't where I wanted to end up. And I just often felt like I can do more, help more, get passionate about certain things, and I was like, what fits that? And then looked into psychology and I've loved every minute of it.
But isn't that the truth of like so many like people who develop a passion for something? Is like we've had something before where we've either felt inadequate, misunderstood, didn't like that feeling, then started exploring in ourselves, realized that there was so much here to identify with, and you like just ignites this fire of curiosity in you where you just want to like, why did I handle something like this and some like other people handle it like this? Or if I completely handle something poorly, like why did I fall apart and other people not? And being able to relate to it, I think, does definitely drive you.
Yeah, for sure. Like I don't think I put it down to one particular moment where I decided like, yep, that's it, I'm studying psych. There's been a lot over the last 10 years coming out of school of learning things where it was going to lead to that, I think. I've always had a knack for wanting to help people or do something different or things like that. Even when I was coaching, it wasn't just on, here's a program, F off, see you later. That was trying to get a lot more hands-on closer with clients. I was nowhere near ahead as where Dalt is now, what he's doing, but that's always where my interest sort of went to. And then from there, even business, understanding trends of why people buy things and stuff, it was always trying to understand people's head. And then obviously when my father passed, I, even after speaking to my own psychologist, I reacted very differently to people. And I instantly just got curious as to why I did that, or like why I found drive in certain things that people found grief and pain and that sort of thing. And I was like, why is this? Why is this happening? And once I started, I couldn't put the books down.
Cool. What do you think's the biggest thing you've learned in that first semester?
There's literally too many things to put it down to. Biggest thing is people's honestly, their own mindset, perception of things. We go a lot into determinism versus free will, and that just sparks so many conversations. Like, you can't stop that conversation once the train gets rolling. But people's abilities to understand their own consciousness, their own brain, things like that, like, once you start, there's no putting that book down. And it's just a conversation that psychologists have been trying to study for years now. Once I started looking into that, I was just like mind blown by the way everyone can experience the same thing and experience it differently. Even psychologists that have different what we call perspectives, or would be fields of study, would look at a situation differently, which just makes so many opportunities to learn different ways of viewing things. You know, your perception, optimism, stoicism, nihilism, like the way people interpret a situation and then break that down, make the decisions, affect their life from that, it just blew my mind the second I started reading it.
Cool. And have you been able to kind of see with, and because obviously before everything closed down, still training with people, have you been able to see how different people that are training that may not be as well educated in that kind of field, and when I say as well educated, have any education within there at all, how have you noticed that you can identify an issue or believe you can identify an issue that may be holding them back? And are they open to receiving that sort of information? Or, like, I guess it wouldn't even be receiving information. Would they be open to any type of suggestion? Because that's really all I guess you could do at the moment, like, legally, is suggest.
Yeah, well, something. Like, that's the crazy thing is at the moment is everyone has a plan when things go great.
Yep.
And the second things are flipped to shit, you start to see how people actually act, react, bounce back, make decisions on the fly, improvise. And there's been... I would say there's been a lot of good and people that are just finding new ways to move and get creative and that sort of thing, and fantastic. But then there's been the polar opposite where people just shut down, go into their shell, retract, you know, their emotions start getting the better of them, and even conversing with them can be hard. Like, they get very shut down, they don't want to discuss it, they're just like, that's it, this is what's happening for the next 6 months, I've got to be depressed and miserable about it. Then there's the people that are like, cool, this is what's happening, how do I make the best of the situation? And that's where I try to encourage all people to be, because if it's out of your control, there's no point stressing about it. That's just another stressor, another anxiety that in a world like this at the moment, you don't need any more than what's already going on. So to see people heading that direction is good. And I try to encourage more people to go that way. Everything that I talk about or like refer to people is trying to be that way.
Yeah.
But there is still, yeah, there's a lot of people that... you know, they had the drive when everything was easy, they had the goal when everything was easy, the ambition or the direction, but the second it came to altering their life routine, their plan, it was like World War III, shit hit the fan, what the hell do I do? Mm-hmm. And they are the ones that you sort of see retract and go in their shell, and they kind of need more attention, but obviously when they hide themselves and they're locked in isolation, they don't get that, and it's hard to communicate exactly what they're, why they're doing certain things. But yeah, they're... It's been good and bad because you see a lot of people go the way you think they should go.
Yep.
But then the way some people have just recluded, tucked themselves in and just sort of given up and like the world's gone to shit, they're needing a bit more help that I try to talk to where I can, suggest, if you will.
Okay, cool. And let's take a step back before we get any more into what's going on now. Run us through what training had looked like from about September last year to... March, mid-March, and then run us through now the type of things that you've had to change. And I feel as well, so like we've already had one conversation last week about this, but I feel there was almost like a week, there was a week leading up to when gym shut down, so we'll just call it the shutdown because that's when most of the shit hit the fan. There was a week leading up to that where people were starting to get smart. They were kind of aware like, yeah, you know, something's going on, but it's probably not going to affect us. Then that week happened, that Sunday happened, and then it went woof, and everyone kind of was like, well, okay, like, I know personally I was in like kind of, not shock, but just like, all right, this is weird, yeah, cool, let's make something happen. Then the week after you started, hit the ground running, I was like, yeah, cool. Mm-hmm. So run us through from about September to March, that kind of 2 week period, I guess, leading up when, you know, uncertainty, and then when the hammer fell, and then to now.
Well, I'll let you probably explain the programming and sort of how you wanted to structure it, and then it'll be a lot easier to go into.
Yeah, cool. So we still had him, obviously, game in that time. We we're in an accumulation and intensification phase. Just means obviously trying to just add as much volume, much work done as possible, and then slowly transfer it over into some strength training. Then that started to beat up his joints a little bit. I was getting messages about like how brutal his lower back and stuff was getting, and I was like, all right, cool, we capped out like on your maximum recoverable volume right there. So let's we change the program from a more global approach to more specific. So instead of doing something like upper lower or push pull splits, we like dove down one step and increase the frequency and just like spread the volume across the week a little bit more, just to increase his recovery times and capacity. And so we've just finished up with that, and then coming into that 2 week period, actually hit really perfectly with his like deload and switch over, which was going to be pulling back into more of a power building recomp phase that we're going into for this comp. So it was going to be maintaining the strength that we'd build, but really start maintaining or increasing slowly the total amount of volume that he was doing in his hypertrophy intensification, his accumulation phases. So with those, with the timing of the chaos and that breakdown and stuff, to have that deload week was kind of really perfect. And then we just had access to a little bit of equipment that I had at home, or that I'd bought previously, or that he was able to scrounge up. So then we switched to full body training multiple times a week, just to be able to get him as much movements and stuff as possible, get as much of the muscles being stimulated as possible. And I set the volume landmarks for it very, very, very low, so that we could have potential to run into this for as long as this shutdown would go on.
Yep.
And we've just been testing and adjusting ever since.
Yeah, so going back to September, I think I just started training with Tom around then.
Tom at the time?
Yeah, Tom at the time. Yeah, yeah. So...
Is that Tom and Time, did you say?
No,
Tom at the time. Yeah.
Like, yeah, yeah. Called Time.
No, no.
Cool man. Father Time.
Pretty slow blood. No, so coming out of comp, I'd spent most of the time training on my own, as that's what got me through what I did going into comp as well.
Yep.
So I spent a lot of intensity and stuff trying to push myself and capping out my max intensity individually.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tom jumped on with Dolt as well. And he's an old mate of mine, and we're both sort of training at any times regardless. So we said, look, why don't we actually start doing this a similar program at the same time, really push the most out of this off season. And then, yeah, so around September, we started really training together anyway, which was good. It allowed us to sort of amp up weight, train intensity, volume, where I might have slacked off myself.
Mm-hmm.
Just those one or two extra reps that you just physically can't get.
Yep.
Or you've got to go to a place to get them out that not every session's going to have.
Mm-hmm.
Having someone there for the first time in probably 3 years of training with Dolt, just saw some numbers go up. That was really good. So, food got to push up. Like condition gave way. That was like, we discussed that coming out of prep regardless. Like it was, I need to get as big as I can, as tight as I can, as much muscle mass as I can. That's going to require body fat. So we pushed that up pretty high. I think I maxed out, would have been December. I sort of pushed around to 106. So my stage weight at Arnold's was 81.4. So that's about 25 kilo gain in 9 months. So I was pretty happy with that. Obviously there's a lot of water weight and volume and stuff like that. But I mean, yeah, 25, 26 kilos isn't a chunk change sort of off season. Mm. And then yeah, from there into the new year, same sort of thing. We adjusted the training just slightly, rechanged the program structure. Everything was going swimmingly. It was awesome. Training was good. Recovery was good. Food was good. And then we started laying out plans for what season B will look like. So when we started looking at when do we implement the cunt phase, when do we start looking at recomposition, at what condition we expect to start prep, so things can just start in as easy a position as possible. And the coolest thing, I found a file on my computer the other week, actually, I'd wrote out at the start of uni, when I had some downtime on campus, about what I wanted off season look like. And we went back through it, and literally I was going through it and could see we ticked every single box that I'd written down about the micro plan and macro plan, which has really re-emphasized the purpose to us, or me especially, of why having an off-season structure is so important.
Yep.
It just literally every single box was ticked off, and the time frame was spot on to exactly what we listed, which meant Dolt's head was where I wanted to be, my head was where I wanted to be, my physique was where we wanted to be. And then yeah, March we started the pretty aggressive cut. We did 4 weeks of some pretty intense, we cut it down to 3 weeks.
3 weeks.
We went pretty well. Like it happened really quickly. How quickly I lost weight, how quickly I dropped body fat, but held muscle. So Instead of doing 4 weeks of aggressive hell, we did three. Had an extra week in there with a refeed, and then we started recompositioning, which brings us to the end of April. Mm-hmm. So the whole idea there was to, we're high-low cycling with carbs, so some pretty low days, about 1,800, shooting up to about 37 to 4,000, just adjusting some carbs and fats, which is allowing body fat to drop off but hold as much muscle as it can. Training-wise, there was, like, at the start of the whole period, I had to get in my own head and sort of say, wake up a bit, like, the intensity just wasn't there at home sessions. Like, I don't care what anyone says. I know it too. I experience it, and it's hard to kick your own ass at home when the couch is there, the food's there, the snacks are there, and you just look at it going, this session doesn't need to be an hour. It doesn't need to be 45. I can do it in half an hour. So, having it written down and just going through those changes, getting in the mindset of this is what 6 months is going to look like. So there's no point slacking off or sulking about it. And that's where that slack came, I was talking about before, is just being in that position of being more optimistic, making the most of it, like, fuck it, this is it. So there's no point sulking about it. It's either I lose the gains I've made, waste 12 months of what I've done, or maximize what we've got and just find a way to make it work.
Definitely. And is there any kind of talk or information relay from the organization coming down when season, is it going to be called A or B?
We believe it's going to be season B. So far there, some of the federations have calendar dates and stuff set in place that they would have just, they're just holding in case restrictions and stuff ease up. But season A was pulled with about 3 or 4 weeks before it was started running in. I can't remember now where.
Season A got canned for most division federations. Season A got canned, it would have been maybe a week or two before the actual gym closures. It was like the end of March. Arnold's and the IFBB ran their show in a very health orientated, secure way of doing it. They had an empty spectators, but they audio streamed it, visual streamed it. The only people allowed at the back of the venue this time were the athletes going on stage. So they warm up and they pump up and then straight on stage. There was no
hangout
or community. There was nothing there. It was just backstage, pump up, oil up, get on stage. Kudos to Doherty for running it. It was against a lot of people's advice or opinions, but to be so close to Arnold's, having done it myself and knowing what that hell would have felt like, I can appreciate why he did it, not just for himself as a business, but for the athletes in general. I mean, if you think about what Doherty lost, he had to sacrifice the Arnold's event, like the festival had to be shut down. So they would have lost millions in business generation, sales and all that sort of jazz, tickets, but then to still go, well, the athletes are here, I want to run it for the athletes. Pretty commendable thing for him to do. The field probably wasn't going to be as big because there was a lot of people uncertain that pulled out with interstate travel, international travel, there's usual national teams that come from around the world that bring big name people that tend to compete, but hats off to the guys who pushed through and made it. Obviously, like, they still stuck it out in hell, in uncertainty and not knowing what's going on. So they did that for season A. I would be maybe assuming they try and do the same sort of thing, push it as much as they can to make sure the season still runs on time.
So the mid-year stuff is until August, September, and then the season B is technically October.
Late
September, October.
Because there is usually a mid-season, mid-year show that allows you to qualify for the Amateur Olympia and go over to Las Vegas. Obviously, that has probably will be pushed back or not on. That'd be hard to say, but likelihood is it's not going to be on with interstate or international travel restricted. But I'd just say that the similar sort of thing will happen with season B. They'll restrict international travel. Depends if they open back up domestic borders. But either way, we're still hopeful to aim for as many. My plan was to do as many shows as I could. The thing with Australian competition circuit is you usually find guys will do one show, qualify, then do the national pro qualifier. To me, I don't see the logic in getting down to that body fat and only being there for like a week and all that hard work for a week. Me coming from a league background, you do preseason for the season and you play 24 games or whatever it is in the year. So this time I want to really push my physique and maximize as many shows, try different things like Dalton, no doubt have different carb techniques or loading techniques, front end, back end, carb cycling, whatever it is to push in volume, see how we look. So get about at least 3 or 4 shows out in the year, hopefully. Place or not, I know for a fact I'll be in a lot better position than I was last time. So I'm just happy to try and see where we can push physique to and maximize each show.
Yeah, definitely.
How are you finding at the moment with training, and I guess sort of in a gym, you're going to have a lot more luxury of being able to do different exercises with different bits of kit, different machinery,
all
of that. How are you finding, I guess, your not so much drive level, you've got the goal, you want to get there, but how are you finding the program at the moment, purely from, I guess, an entertaining point of view?
Yeah, so I think the way me and Dalt sat down, sort of spoke about it, he had a picture in his head. You no doubt go into that after that as well. He had a picture in his head of what we knew he had on the balcony. Like, literally the balcony is about 5x2. And yeah, we had an idea of what's adjustable, what can be moved, what can be used, some extra bands and stuff like that, to how we can incrementally increase volume and stuff. So the enjoyability factor isn't as high by any means. Like, I just love the feel of being in the gym. It's not just a weightlifting session. It's literally my psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. Is where I get my, as much as it's a physiological stressor, it's also a de-stressor for me. So, mm-hmm. To be in the environment of a gym, whether it's a loud banging gym like Worlds or it's just a local franchise gym like Anytime, the feel of just being in the gym is something else. Mm-hmm. And yeah. So on the balcony, like, I can get into the mindset as much as I can. And it does take some days where I kick myself in the ass to do it. Like, you come home from work and the bed's there, or like, you know, get changed, quickly check the phone, all of a sudden half hour's gone by. So I've got to try and minimize that to maximize my time now for training and uni. But at the end of the day, I want to train, I want to compete, and this is the shit you have to do. So not everything's ideal and enjoyable. Dalt can go into how he structured the program and what that's going to look like, or what it looks like for now. It's enjoyable in that we get to mix it up. That's probably the best bet.
You find you're doing obviously you'll be doing different stuff, but are you finding as well, Dalt, too, both of you can answer this, are you finding you're doing more things you wouldn't do in a gym? And Dalt, are you finding you're having to program different things that you would in a gym, but still to achieve the same stimulus?
Yeah, so the idea is to try and mimic as many of the movement patterns that we want to load, obviously, the muscles that need work still or stimulus, and try and keep that focus there. So it's just a matter of adjusting the course and mm-hmm. finding what we have to work. Definitely different. Machines, mechanisms, loads and stuff that you can normally do freely and just adjust one pin mm-hmm. is now like three or four different pieces of equipment, or like some bands with an adjustable squat rack kind of thing. And mm-hmm. For me personally, yeah, it's definitely a little bit on the different side, but gotta make do, I guess.
Yeah. For me, it's more my philosophy of how I program training is what influenced where we're at. When I get someone to train, I regress them to the point that I start finding their results. So they might come to me and tell me that they've been training for 2 or 3 years, and I put them through a testing week or some movements, and I watch what their body does, I watch how they respond, and if I watch them train like crap, or if I have to refocus on wrong movements and stuff like that, I'll keep stripping them down until we find a new baseline. And then realistically, then I explain to them, like, look, this is where you're actually at. You think you're at 3 years or 4 years of training, stuff like that, but realistically, we've only had like 6 months of proper training. So
yeah,
we need to like pull it back from here. So with that, knowing that they've had that, I then use as many basic techniques to build people up to that point and slowly transition them through their training age from a beginner to an intermediate to an advanced intermediate to an advanced athlete. So with Ben, he hasn't maximized out on some of these like more novel techniques and stuff like that, which is great because that means like we don't have to employ other techniques to get the same responses. It's easier for him, but with losing out on some of these capacities that like machines bring out, or a change in environment, even just being somewhere different and being able to get into that mindset and having a different level of intensity, if we don't have, if we know that's going to be sacrificed, I've had to introduce some training techniques that I normally wouldn't necessarily do until a little bit later on. So that could be stuff like blood flow restriction training, which is just occlusion training where you wrap bands around you, stop the blood from returning to the body, and you accrue as much metabolic damage as possible in those muscles, which makes people like hate their life. Giant sets, drop sets, tri sets, pyramid sets, extended sets, like anything that I can do that would go away from the traditional 1 second up, eccentric, concentric, pause, you know, 1 second eccentric, and then hold and kind of start again, regular tempo, no time on tension training, very low fatigue developing exercises, whereas now it's like, okay, if we can't get intensity as high and our our loads are definitely limited and we can't get intensity as high, what other ways can I make Ben question his life by imposing different training techniques onto him? So I've had to employ a lot of those. And with the training structure that I've built out for him, there's a lot of, I left spots for individual flexibility. I left exercises for him to say, like, all I need out of this exercise here, if you to finish out this day, is another quad exercise. But if you're overdoing these ones or whatever, or you like really enjoying something that week, repeat that exercise, keep doing that, find that enjoyment and stuff like that. So let's use that. If you're really finding that split squats are like killing you and your like hips are starting to give out, like avoid them, give yourself a little bit more time, or do some sissy squats or goblet squats or whatever it is that you really find enjoyment. So it's a lot of more how I would program for a gen pop person, asking like, what do you enjoy and what do you not? But it's also saying, hey man, we've got to like figure out every other way that we can increase or bring back up that same training quality that we had when we had access to gyms.
Yep.
So I've done a lot of employing around that. And also like ignoring his whining and just keep telling him that like we need to like just keep pushing through for certain aspects. You know, like wear and tear on joints and stuff like that. It's like, okay, yeah, we're just gonna have to toe the line as much as we can and really make him push on, you know, stretching flexibility routines, make him work on rolling out and cooling down techniques and stuff like that to increase his recovery fatigue management, rather than just focusing on the quality of sessions and stuff like that. So when that area is limited, or we have to work around it, finding the other areas to really balance that out. And it's a bit of an eye-opener for him, going like, oh, okay, maybe I do have a little bit more ROM stuff that I need to work on, or like my flexibility maybe sucks a little bit in these areas. So like seeing that, especially in a time where it's not damaging to his physique, or it's not inhibiting taking any trophies, it's like, oh, well, if you can realize that now, we can start making these changes now. For people to have the strongest drive to want to make a change, you have to show them that they're, like, what they're not capable of doing. Yep. So then him seeing that, realizing his own limitations and going, oh, fuck, I'm going to have to, like, work on this. You know, if I can't get myself into these positions, how am I going to get into stage positions at this new heavier weight? You know, it's a different size to him. He hasn't been this big before. So that means restrictions on, like what he's had to do, what he's let himself do for flexibility routines and mobility before, now has to like be a lot higher, and he has to enforce it. And then I'm also there to see it, which is like even just like that's the other side of it as well. Like when he trains with himself, he's only had himself to push, which is something that I wanted to touch on before. Is that psych is insane. Like to be able to push yourself and keep training by yourself, most people don't have that. And so to have a longer time period that he was able to do that is awesome. But also now that he has someone else to train, it's kind of a little bit of competition, which intrinsically just pushes their training capacity up. But then the other side of it is, now that he's at home and training at home, like I'm around, so I can see his training quality, and I can see when I need to step in and talk to him or like help him out and stuff like that. So it's like there's on the other end of the spectrum is, whilst he's at home not able to do the same quality that he was doing in the gym, there are other aspects that really do help balance that back out.
Perfect. What would a program look like what would Ben's program look like if in the next 2 weeks gyms were open as opposed to September?
I would probably swap him over to, like, I'd pull off any of the crazy fatigue accumulation stuff that we've been doing, like blood flow restriction training, drop sets,
back to basics. Sets.
Yeah, I'd drop it back to a very standard approach like that, but I'd throw him on machines just for a simple novel approach of having had to work on freeway compounds for so long. I'd be like, let's get on some machines, like get lazy, use like mind muscle connection stuff like that, focus on those areas and try and find the mind muscle connection, that you chase that pump and enjoy the novel stimulus of being on machines again, ease up some of his joint pain that has probably really started to accumulate lately, and let those areas heal and recover out.
Cool. So it would basically be the same.
Yeah, I'd just essentially swap from like a free weight barbell bench press to like a machine chest press or something like that. Keep his volume landmarks and everything else the same, because nothing else realistically should change outside of maybe some of the inflammation that he's accruing, that he might see a reduction in that just because of not being stressed, having a high, like more enjoyment in his training means, yep, that there's a drop in that like inflammation markers that were we would see typically around someone who's being beat up and not recovering as well. So
yeah, cool. As well with that, Ben, how do you feel at the moment with your body? Like, because the capacity in which we're able to train and then the in different ways, so when inflammation or issues do become a problem, we can switch across the machine, take out certain core elements, so you know, well, like what you just exactly said, Doc. How are you finding the body's going, because you're only very restricted to this one certain, and I know you change out the programming as much as you can, but yeah, at the end of the day, it's free weight and it's mostly volume.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's so much volume. It's so much volume.
Forever volume.
It's good in that we had to strip so much back and allow chance for future progression. Yep. Like we sort of discussed about, you know, if this looks like it's going to be a 6-month thing, we don't want to cap out straight away and then have no room to go grow or stimulate or, you know, hypertrophy, progressive overload, things like that. So the body's taking a beating to the sheer free weights. You know, my lower back, as it is already flares up. You know, to see a physio. It's not that we did anything wrong. It's just that from time to time with my injury from like 9 years ago now, what was it, 7 years ago, it just accumulates.
Yeah.
And it's just, there's just times where it's got to be like, all right, cool, I just got to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
It might be time where I forget in my head to rehab or prehab or move properly. It's a good indicator usually for me that I've gotten sloppy on form. So it's sort of just like, as painful it is, as dumb as it is, it's almost like an indicator to switch back on in my head, be a bit more aware. So the back's taken a little bit of a beating with going from so many controlled movements and machines to everything being either freestanding or hinging with free weight joints. Just, yeah, they're not horrible, but it was noticeable going from so many machines, cables, and that sort of thing, structured setting, to having to adjust to whatever we had. But like I said, you know, the plan is to progressively increment slowly, find ways around it to make the most of it, so we don't just jack it up straight away and then throw my back out and throw anything out, and all of a sudden, you know, we've tried to max the load we have or max the exercises. We can strip it back, drop the weight, and then look at progressing.
Yeah.
Slower increments.
Yeah, those progressions, like for kind of what Ben's getting at there, is we're looking at like increase in rep quality as a really key example, right? So I might set him a rep range of something like between 8 and 12 reps for a barbell bench press. And it, okay, so set a load that we can have at home that you max out 1 to 2 reps pretty close to failure, maybe 3 or 4 to like for the volume that will slowly improve, but have those targets in mind, set that weight, do the work, then find that 8 rep range where you feel that. So if all the boxes are ticked for that, it's like, all right, next set, you don't try and push for 9 or 10 or something like that. Let's increase the quality of 8 reps across the board. So 8 reps has to happen 3 or 4 times across the session so that I can go, cool, then there's a rep increase like that. So it doesn't have to be 8 reps to 10 reps or 30 reps or something like that, massive progressions. We're intentionally slowing it down so that he has room for that accumulation to happen over time. Since we know this is here for a while, there's no rush, and since we have a limited capacity of what our ceiling looks like, there shouldn't be a rush. We should really try and make the most out of as much quality that we can gain from this over the time, as well as setting ROM boundaries. So instead of allowing him to like free weight squats and stuff like that, he has targets of like how low he needs to go to be able to hit the bottom for a rep to count and stuff like that. So we're like consistency, which you'd get that in like a hack machine or a Smith machine or something like that. But when you don't have that and you're limited here, squatting down onto a bench or squatting down onto a low set bar, some set of weights or something like that, just to reconfirm what a rep looks like and to maximize full ROM across the board, like those quality aspects of training as opposed to just the generic keep progressing kind of thing.
Yeah.
So we're just pretty much taking away from progression. When a lot of people discuss progressive overload, they just consider weight.
Yeah.
Which is fine. That is definitely a means, a modality of that when you have a gym that has an almost unlimited amount of weight. But there's also then aspects we have to consider about total rep range, total volume range, total set range,
mm-hmm.
And then tempos, and then like form, intensity. Like you can increase all the weight you want, but if the intensity of the set isn't that great, you're then missing out on so much more. Like, you know, there's a difference between someone who trains to the boxes and someone who trains with intensity.
Yeah.
Sure, obviously we want to do all those things, and to maintain intensity as you progress as well is fucking hard.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, those are all the things we have to consider for what could be what started maybe a month ago, and it may have to last 3 to 6 months leading into comp. So it's a matter of cutting back on just thinking about progression as weight, and looking at all the aspects that encompass what progression will look like on a balcony with 2 meters to work with.
Yeah, which is a complete opposite to what you'd expect from like a normal client who has no competition experience or expectations and stuff like that.
You just be encouraged to move.
Right, so like their thing is half the time their mindset that they don't want to be here, they're doing it because of health reasons or because they just want to look a little bit better naked and stuff like that, but they don't actually love weight training, right? So there's no desire to go, like, how can I pinpoint every aspect that I can make better and make it better for them? It's just, how do I spend this 30 minutes as fast as possible so I can get fucking out of here and go have a beer, like, or go home and watch some Netflix or something? So, like, being able to, like adopt some of those understandings and apply them both inversely, competition and to Gen Pop, really does help as well.
Awesome. All right, let's go on to a few opinion-based questions.
Sick.
Yay.
So this is going to be some good stuff. Right when this kicked off, and around panic buying and all of that, now we're not going to try and go into the opinion of Gen Pop because we already know what that is. Who do you feel is to blame from this panic buying? Is it a cycle of media that are, you know, well, what they have been doing, only cherry picking facts which are going to get ratings, higher ratings, and then talking about this? Because especially with us, the panic buying, it started about 2 weeks when people were just buying up stuff, like they were buying up toilet paper, and then it became a worldwide phenomenon. Where do you think this stems? Whose fault, or where can you kind of place blame? Because really, an intelligent person, and myself and Claude, we got caught out. Like we were just like, this is a fucking joke. And then we actually needed the stuff one day, and then it was almost taboo to buy fucking toilet paper. You're just like, ugh, I'm one of them.
I mean, if you think of it from a psych perspective, we can blame the media for hyping things and picking data, that's sure, but it's people. Like, fear is a strong motivator. I mean, the fear of missing out, the fear of dying, like whatever the fear factor was, people showed their, I don't want to say true natures, but once shit hit the fan, like those repressed or socially acceptable behaviors just went out the window because no one wanted to be left out. And that's what it kind of come down to, is like people being scared of missing out on what they somehow associated to being a savior during a respiratory virus. But yeah, when you sort of start looking at social norms, social psych, and the way populations interact to hold civility and generally be civilized, something like this freaks them the F out, and then they just resort to very basic primal natures, and they put their survival above everyone else. Like, well, everyone else is getting the toilet paper, I don't want to miss out on having toilet paper.
Yeah, there's a couple of aspects here. Hey, so there's like the social norms that like in pandemic and non-pandemic world, so obviously they shift very drastically when there's a pandemic and people needed to have equipment or stuff to survive or be isolated. And the social norm was to buy stuff, because as soon as enough people started to doing it, the whole reason it became panic buying is because it was seen socially acceptable for those who did think that they needed something to go do it. So there's that, as well as kind of a default behavior of you're told that there's going to be some isolation, that you'd need to acquire some essential items. For them, their default was not, I need essential items in a week or two. It's like, I need these essential items now. So there's like two psychological phenomenons that play on there: the social norm, so that people feel included. But then we've got the other side, which Ben was talking about before, is like the consciousness level, where they respond to it as like on a fear-based level. So those are definitely massive influences. I think the media is like obviously largely to blame for a lot of that. I think the policies and stuff done by the government could have been a lot more clearer and a lot more articulate, but I'd love to find out who wrote that initial article that made someone, or like made everyone start going buying out the toilet paper.
That first,
it didn't make any sense for a respiratory disease. So,
yeah,
like, I mean, like, you're not going to be locked in, like, you can still shower and stuff like that. Yeah. So, like, worst comes to worst, like, why is toilet paper that?
Yeah, grab a garden hose.
I think I read it was meant as a meme, but it was actually mathematically worked out for someone buying a 64 roll lot of toilet paper, and the average amount of wipes required for someone who's just done a deuce, the amount of people in the household, I think it was based on four people, and it was something like a 64 lot, if someone isn't just abusing toilet paper in the shitter,
yeah,
would go take them 6 months to get through one 64 lot for the average eating four-person family.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's give or takes where people aren't average. You know,
averages are averages.
But yeah, the average is for a reason, right?
Yeah.
We have bell curves for a reason. And yeah, these people were like, the numbers worked out to be something like 6 months for just a single 64 lot. And then you multiply that by the amount of times people then go back and buy, and they haven't gone through their 64 yet, and they go buy again. And these idiots are going to be, in 6 months' time, left with 3 years' worth of toilet paper.
Yeah.
And realize just how stupid they were in a respiratory virus outbreak that they stocked up on 10 years worth of toilet paper for no reason. That was literally, it's just their basic urges kicked in and they saw everyone else needing it. They thought it was okay. They panicked, didn't want to be left out. And they're just like, well.
And you got sharks as well, people trying to take advantage.
Well, yeah, and then yeah, people capitalize on the market. You try to create a black market of toilet paper and hand sanitizer.
Yeah, yeah, like they were going for ridiculous amounts on eBay, like $100 for like packets and stuff like that. So just people are animals.
I mean, well, that's capitalism for you as well.
Yeah.
I
mean, it's blind,
you
know,
the other option is communism, where you get rationed your toilet paper.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that's 6 months get, suddenly turned into 2 years. There's 64 rolls, make it last.
You get two wipes.
Yeah.
Or no wipes.
It's, I mean, what I want to know now is, like, you, I guess the opinion on government. Personally, where I stand from a ScoMo government is he cocked up in the bushfires, but he's kind of redeemed himself. I'm neutral. I think they're all a bunch of wankers, but I think the way that this got handled is pretty well. And you hear how other countries are going now. Obviously, we're blessed to be an island, but there are also other island countries that are getting pretty fucked up.
Yeah.
So how do you think they've handled it? And I mean, like, you think about everything. And I can also appreciate this from the business point of view as well, how we've had to pivot in this situation, and nothing comes quick. So as soon as you try something new, you're hoping for people to roll with it on the fly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate good abilities to adapt and overcome a situation, and you're not going to get everything perfect. However, even in our business, we've seen, in our organization, we've seen people that can't adapt and overcome.
Oh, yeah,
they,
sure.
They want a tried and true program or something to come out straight away and go, well, why isn't this working? So how do you guys think the government's gone, and then how do you think industry, our industry being fitness, has reacted to that?
Well, I think luckily enough, this semester, one of our key subjects is communication in all fields of medical, communication for a medical practitioner, but communication overall in general is the basis of what we're studying. And I think the biggest issue that I had with him and the way he handled it was communication from the outset. There was very poor direct communication, and when people aren't given clear instruction, like, it might be taken offensive to some people, but you have to dumb it down to the lowest common denominator.
Yep.
In most cases, 9 times out of 10, assume that everyone is just batshit dumb.
Licking eyeballs.
You're literally just drooling on the like kind of thing. Like, that way, everything is clear and precise, and the lowest person can understand what's being said. That was not the case for 90% of this conversation that's had for the last 2 months, three months. That was the biggest issue I had, is where even if he had the right idea or had the right advice, or, you know, debatable on what model he was basing his opinions on, you know, slowly decreasing businesses and things like that, it was a communication of it that really lacked. And I mean, even his own written conversations where he was discussing in front of live media and national media, things like that, like, they already skew stories as best they can. They already talk shit. So if you're not being clear and precise as possible so you can reiterate your point later, it's going to make everyone follow instructions like just hard. And we can see that at Bondi, like, the day after he announced, like, let's start implementing no more than 2 people gatherings, and there's 20,000 people at Bondi Beach. It's not just that, like, people didn't realize, they took it from a very internalized personal perspective, is that, oh, but I'm adhering to this by only being with my friend at the beach, there's 2 of us. But then they don't look at the broader community aspect and go, all right, yeah, there's 2 of us here. There's also 20,000 people within a spectrum of 500 meters. And the way in which we know the spacing needed for this virus to transfer and interaction to transfer and spread it, or continue the spread to happen, they should have been there. But I mean, people, again, if you assume they're dumb and explain things a bit more clearer and your communication is a lot more on point, then you can't play that ignorance as a defense. You just say, right, these people are dumb, they need fines.
Yep.
But because of such a lack in communication to me, even if he had the right models, the right points, the right basis of what his decisions were on, which are debatable, he just it wasn't communicated anywhere near clear enough for everyone.
I didn't have much of an issue with what's happened. It's more of an issue of just the timing. I think there was it was very slow to take off when we've seen other countries like Jacinda made some amazing calls early on and just did it. Because this whole argument people trying to talk about flattening the curve, what you have to understand is to flatten the curve, there has to be an initial spike once and then it kind of just like dumps and after that. So you have to get in front of things to stop it from happening so that you can have a short amount of time. What they were trying to do, and I appreciate it, but I just think I would disagree, could have been done earlier, was they tried to manage the transition to make it as stepped possible that for it to happen. But that in essence extends how much this curve remains flattened, right? So we're expecting periods of 6 to 12 months of restricted movements, activities, things to happen, and potentially till vaccines, whatever the case. So that means that there's like a longer period of time of this, whereas if we can get in front of it, stop it sharper and reduce that time of exposure, we don't actually get as many going on for a longer period of time, which like New Zealand showed really, really well. So that was just more of a timing issue for that.
Like we said on the way over here, do you want to wait and see? Like, you know, we've seen how many epidemics and pandemics in history. Like, do you want to just be another one where you wait and react? Or worst case scenario is you get ahead of it, cool. Mm-hmm. It might be that we overreacted slightly and the model is not as many deaths. But the opposite...
But the answer is not as many deaths.
Yeah, the answer is not as many. But the opposite is a fuck ton.
Yeah.
Like, the answer is then if we take it too slow, we don't react fast enough, as you're saying, then it becomes a hell of a lot more deaths. And then we start saying, oh, in hindsight, we should have reacted a little bit faster, or we should have done things a bit more stricter. So, completely agree.
From a health perspective, I totally get it. Economically, I can imagine trying to balance an economy of a country, and let alone the global economy, to be an absolute nightmare. And I have no education or understanding of that. So, I have nothing to weigh in on that. I'm amazed that we're not in a recession. I'm grateful that our money is at least still working. We've still got our markets and stuff trading.
Money says wallpaper, so, 1940.
Yeah, as much as it seems like a joke, the US could end there, because they're just, what they're experiencing and going through right now is just going to be out of this world. So
it's funny you bring that up. So the opposite to what we've done is herd immunity.
Mm-hmm.
I believe it's Sweden or Switzerland. It's one of the guesses. Sweden.
Yeah.
They're doing herd immunity. So the outcome there is they lose a percentage of the population, yet they're all still working. The economy is working.
Yeah, if you look at the last, because I've been following this nearly daily now, and their models are now starting to show that they're getting overwhelmed. But initially, it looked, for the first 2 weeks, it looked really, really a great idea, and that we should have been doing it. But it's more now to the point that herd immunity, it should be done. So the idea with the herd immunity is that you allow enough people to become infected so that we don't overwhelm the system. But that's the key word, enough people. You don't allow everyone to get infected, because then some people die, and we're trying not to do that. But then the areas like our hospitals and healthcare and police and social services and stuff get overwhelmed, right?
Yep.
So if we allow too many people like that, we fall into chaos. If we allow no one, this complete isolation of countries like New Zealand where they completely shut it down, you potentially don't have any immunity, and we're reliant on vaccines and stuff to happen. This goal of you want to balance that fine line between enough people getting sick and exposed to the disease, building up antibodies and creating this larger herd immunity so that the elderly or those who are most at risk aren't exposed to the virus or have less transmission of the virus. You want to be doing it and balancing that. And we were nowhere near our hospital capacities and stuff like that, which was awesome to see that it never got to that point where we had to potentially this is there's some hospitals and stuff were shutting down depending on how they how infected and stuff that they got, and that still didn't put a burden on our healthcare systems and stuff like that. You saw this up front, there was definitely days that it was stressful, but it wasn't I had to take Isabel to the hospital and
we had to be inside for 3 days.
She had started showing signs and symptoms, and when I went to the hospital and this was right in the peak of that time where everyone was there, the hospital wasn't overwhelmed. There wasn't a line of people outside or craziness that was happening. They had a very professional, every policies on every outcome. And if it started to become infecting the staff, this is their policy. And if it started to become we couldn't do it, then this is their policy. And they had it all set down and planned out. So they've done really, really well in handling it. We just seem to have missed the boat on some of the timing, like the friggin' cruise ship that came in.
The Ruby Princess.
Like, I really, someone needs to be held responsible for making that call, because that was just retarded, whether it be government or whether it be that like captain.
K Rudd released an article, and he's retarded. Trying to frontline it, where he's trying to hold several departments accountable for it, because there was such a rush to get them off the boat for some reason. I haven't been on a cruise ship to know how returning customs works, but there was no checking. Even knowing that COVID was on the ship, there was no rush to check everyone individually. It was like sort of get them off and try and get them home or isolated, whatever they were trying to do.
And also their instructions how to get home. Like,
yeah, there was no public transport. There was no one gathered people. It was just get home. And that was on public transport, taxis, boats, buses, trains, whatever they had to do to get home. Back on the boat, go out. You're back out to sea.
Yeah, it was bad. It was just ridiculous.
It was poorly handled. And then on top of that, there was the border security that had no control there either. Mm-hmm. And so K Rudd's thing is like, there's at least three departments here, whether that's heads up or whether that's like individuals on the day need to be held accountable. But what, of 200 cases now, there's something like 70% of Australia's infected have been a result of that ship. Like, something like their deaths have directly been responsible for
so
that.
I think it's 80% of infectious cases have come from that ship and then transference from the people on that ship.
Fucking
so
insane.
It was I've got a client who's deep on the inside with Queensland Health, and I guess saying which is an already known stat, there's really only 3-5% of cases that are untraceable, mm-hmm. so they've not been able to find out, and that's one of the things that are holding a lot of things up. Stuff, so before we can open up gyms and open up more areas, it's we need to account where these people have been, who they've come in contact with, and then from there it becomes a lot easier. So
the second wave infections on pandemics are insane. Like, that's one of the most contentious subjects around epidemiology and pandemic and virology and stuff like that. So it's like every evidence of a pandemic in the past that shows that there's like this resurgence of second round transmissions and stuff that happens.
And it's already happened around the world. People where they think they've
Taiwan, I've got clients there. Yeah, expats were allowed back in and they started infecting everyone again. They went out drinking. I was like, oh, great.
There was surprisingly a study that came, like how reliable it will be is debatable, but the initial 100 or 1,000 of from Wuhan that showed symptoms, of that 5-15% are reinfecting because they just got cured over and they were all good, their symptoms passed and then just went back out into life.
I don't know if it's a China study. I don't trust
That's what I mean. It's completely possible.
Super racist. All of a sudden, China.
They're good.
Zero cases. Like, okay, cool.
Spiking to be the highest, and it's gone.
Nice work, China. Also, I don't live at 48 Manning Street.
I guess the biggest thing as well, if we look at a Gen Pop now, you are seeing the two types of people, those that are getting into fitness or that are continuing fitness, and those that are going down the rabbit hole of becoming a slug.
Yeah, self-pity and wallowing.
So one thing that I have noticed when I go out on lunchtime walks and stuff is I'm seeing people that have quite clearly not exercised in years. Not even really. So I see this is especially for those type of people that may have not had, they may have always had all these options, gyms, this group classes, online training. They've had all this ability, but now just stepping home and working from home, they're now like, I'm going to take it on myself. So I see that as a good light for them. I know the people that are at the pity party at the moment, they may take a while to get back into fitness, but there's a pretty good chance that they're going to get back into it.
There will be a bounce back. Like, we also have to consider from a psychological standpoint the effects that isolation, withdrawal, depression can all cause. Like, it is a trauma in of itself. It's a stressor of itself. We are social creatures. And to then be told we have to stay inside and away from friends and conversation and stuff like that, where, yes, a phone call can substitute the conversation, but the interaction can't be substituted. And so there are people who are going to handle that, like, it's not so much handling it poorly, because it's not a choice to be in that depressed state, or like 9 times out of 10. But there are also things that we can kind of change ourselves and get ourselves in a better position to fix it. Like, you might not want to do it, but you can also create habits and situations where you can be better from it. And the good thing is that people are realizing that basic health is, you know, the way that we got around this disease or the virus early on was basic health practices, like just moving, basic dieting, some health, eating nutritiously. Like, so now people are starting to see that just taking care of yourself is very simple. Mm. And like that was the advice given when it sort of took off. So there are the two camps, but I think there will be a bounce back. These people do have to understand, whilst I criticize and say there are, you know, the two parties, I'm also very much consciously aware though also that there are those going through depression, mental illness, suicide, isolation, but we can't just stay there and say, oh, it's cool, you're there. Like, we'll, you know, we feel sorry for you. We've got to get you out of that as well. Mm-hmm. And it's the ones who aren't thinking that way, or who are showing that they, you know, we can go for a walk, we can go for a run, I can now get outside and mm-hmm. see the world that I wasn't seeing, just general, like, outdoor exercise and outdoor movement, that's going to get them back to doing that.
Yeah, hopefully it does a whole lot of reframing for people who had a work-life balance where work was dominated or their environment didn't allow for them to try and explore some health and fitness stuff. Like, we see a large amount of weight in obese people in the country, so a lot, like, we can understand a lot of work environments are not set up conducively towards health and fitness. A lot of their like career advice and stuff like that is not conducive to health and fitness is, yeah, do whatever you have to make sure that you like climb that ladder. So hopefully we're seeing some changes in work environments and people being able to work from home allows them greater access to being health and healthy and fit and getting outside and enjoying those
just
benefits.
Just enjoying being outdoors.
Yeah, so hopefully we see a large amount of that as well. I think that will be a lot of mental contrasting for people to have experience, and hopefully that keeps up a resurgence when we transition out of this pandemic.
It's good, like I know it's just, even when in prep you've got to hit your step targets, like there's a vast difference in how you feel between doing your steps on a treadmill and feeling like it's a chore, and just throwing on a podcast or an audiobook and just going for a walk down the beach or down the river or on the water or footpath and park, whatever. There's just a huge difference in how you feel afterwards, beforehand, like the way you react afterwards. It's just, there's definitely some benefits now in this, seeing people be able to get outside and just enjoy a walk.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. All right, boys. So what I want to know, as a part of the wrap-up questions now, there's a before and during now. Mm-hmm. So run me through morning routine pre-March and post-March, if there has been any change at all.
Yeah, so for me, pre and post-March, most of my life, luckily, has been the same. I'm very much, I would say, an isolation kind of creature, but routine is definitely a thing for me. So I have kept my fasting from last prep. So I tend to not have my first meal until my work about 10, 11 o'clock. I make morning coffee, get up, shower, get ready, do my weigh-in, like weigh myself. Maybe 5 minutes of posing. Luckily now my bedroom, now we've moved, has got like a floor to ceiling roof, so go through a quick bit of posing myself.
Mirror,
floor to ceiling roof. It's a good roof.
It's old wall.
But yeah, my morning routine is pretty much the same. And then yeah, just basically coffee, get ready, go to work, start the day. Days off a little bit different. I try to relax a bit more on the days off, get into some study, do some reading. Take my steps first thing because I'm not going to be at work to walk around, so I get my steps in. But yeah, other than that, most of my routine for the morning has been exactly the same.
Dog.
Yeah, I'd have to say I'm complete opposite. Hey, mine's been impacted severely. I went from doing heaps of stuff in the morning, like fasted. I like to do faster training and just my faster cardio, because I tend to find if I train with food in my stomach, I throw up a lot because either I just train a little bit too intense for food sitting in my belly. And the army really made me throw up all the time whenever you had something in your stomach from like their ridiculous training sessions. So now I just can't stomach, like I literally can't stomach it through the part of the pun. But so I do it faster training or faster walks. Now, I get so wound up in this like innate expectation that any clients and stuff that are working with me, if I'm at home, that I should be like waking up, getting onto their stuff, going straight away. And so now I've kind of incorporated that to get all the work done as fast as possible so that I can then start exploring doing things and stuff afterwards, which really isn't conducive towards my training. Like, I hate training with food in my stomach, I hate training afterwards, because to go from being empathetic and sympathetic to people to this like aggressive mindset of kill those weights and change your body and stuff back to being like, I can't make that like flexible shift. So I find it just so tiring, and I just procrastinate. I just can't get back there, and like quality work and stuff suffers. So I know I can't do it afterwards. But the thing is, I've just had like just suffered through making poor choices to get there, and then had to create a new business and stuff like that. So that's just been adding on stresses and taking away time availability and stuff like that. But then what I had done in the last couple of weeks was I delved into the research around rest time periods around hypertrophy and training. So that, like we see that there's between too little time and too much time, there's like the same amount of gains for people. If people take too little rest, they can't actually train to the same quality, or they induce too much stress, their body fatigues too early. Whereas if they have longer time rest periods, they have high quality training. We actually don't have an upper threshold of how high that time period can be between a session. So I went diving into that. I looked into the prehab literature, I looked into the hypertrophy literature, I looked into like animal models and stuff like that. There's nothing around it, because most people approach fitness thinking, what's the minimum I have to do to train? No one's going, how long can I make the session last and still get the same gains? No one's thinking, like, how do I make an 8-hour workout? Like, no one thinks about it in that aspect. Yeah, well, unless you're Rihanna, so. So what I started looking into that, so I started exploring that and just found that after I did a client check-in, I'd go and do a set of like curls or a set of like bench press or a set of squats or something like that, and just slowly drip feed my training across the day. So as opposed to having this one clumped time period of training in the morning, that I could do my clients, like, you know, have that stress of seeing my laptop, they're feeling that stress and want to help people do that, and then, you know, breaking it up by doing some exercise. So I kind of had that balance in the last couple of weeks, and then with the shift into the new business, this is all window, like everything out the window for the
moment. I definitely say too, we're both on campus studiers. Have to be on campus, but I definitely,
Isabel, you eat too loudly.
I definitely enjoy being on campus more to focus on the content and being like, all right, I'm in uni, I'm in that mindset. It's like the gym. I switch my mindset and just go, I'm in that environment, this is what I'm doing. So trying to flick over to just online learning has definitely been hard for me. And that's changed probably my routine the most, is that my days off used to be right campus for like 6 or 7 hours, get my steps while I'm there, walk around, read whatever between classes or units. And he'd probably be much the same. He preferred to be on campus. So that's probably been a big impact for me, is not just training wise, but for study.
For me, the online learning wasn't so much the difficult part. It's that no separation between, like, I've worked from home for years, and so I've never had an issue with that, but having to work from home, study from home, and eat from home, and then have a whole bunch of people there as well, that's where it really messed me over, because I like being by myself. I actually recharge on having no one around me, so it just makes me feel better.
Yep.
And having people always around me now is like, okay, cool, this is tiring. And it's like, it does. It, like,
as well, just
when
chats.
When it's not your thing, it really does wear on you. And like, it makes me respect like what people, like what clients have to go through all the time, where they're in environments that they can't change, and that stuff like that does wear on them. It's made me realize maybe some different approaches and stuff that I can take with people, or ways that we can explore setting up, like micro environment changes and stuff like that, instead of being able to work with their macro environment. It could be something as small as, you know, different like positive messaging and stuff that they have, like changing like the things that they see around them, removing some options away from them, not having food out available, you know, having water and fruit like freely visible, like small micro changes like that, just to help them be able to incorporate the long-term health habits that we're trying to maintain. But because that makes it easy, right? Like, there's not as much mental effort in having to reach for fruit when it's there in front of you, and water when it's there in front of you, instead of if it's inside a cupboard and you have to go past that cupboard, like chocolates or chips or anything like that, you have to go past
that. Also snacks.
Like, right? Like, it's totally legit, because when I like faced with those choices, half the time I'm like, fuck, I could totally eat like a whole bag of these. Why not? Like, so I get it, I see it, and I experience it, and going through that has just been a pretty cool eye-opener on some of those things.
Very nice. Biggest takeaway from everything that's happened?
Probably get a burger.
The Coles $5 pizza.
Yeah.
Biggest takeaway is... we are adaptive.
Mm.
I think that's a huge takeaway. as a species, as people individually, as a group, communally, like everything about us, we are adaptive to stresses, situations, environments, microenvironments. If we can't find a way to do something, or sorry, if something can't be done the way we were doing it, it's not that hard for us to change and still, it's kind of pivot or adjust and still reach the same outcome. Which I think has been a big eye opener for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, we see that in bodybuilding and stuff where you might get a niggle or a training or, you know, a piece of equipment's been taken away or the gym might not have the gear, and we can just say, all right, cool, we're going to do the same movement, we're going to do this and adjust. But for Gen Pop that don't have to experience that constantly all the time, they're getting their routine and their habits and their cycle, and like, that's it, that's their little bubble, that's all they experience. They don't have to adjust and adapt. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, definitely that we are adaptable if put in the circumstance and people forced to do it, they will adapt.
It makes sense as like part of the reason why we're like the dominant species on this planet, right? Like, regardless of what the environment that we've been able to inhabit them all. So like that, like we can just find ways for all of those things. But we're also we're responsive to our environment and stuff as well. So like whilst we can live in it and, you know, help shape it, we're also shaped by it. So what we allow and the things that we encourage or give permission to be in and around us also is like permission for how we will eventually change. A great easy example of that is like giving permission for a large availability of like fast food chains and stuff like that to be around us means like that we also have to be accepting of the fact that this ease of access to hyperpalatable calorie dense food is going to increase in part to, you know, weight gain and stuff down the line. So there's like obviously things that we can be influenced by and take control of, but there's obviously a cost and influence from those things as well.
Perfect. And lastly, any YouTube accounts, Instagram accounts, or podcasts that you're liking at the moment, are you getting any benefit from? Doesn't have to be one of everything, just anything that stands out that you're enjoying.
Study-wise now. A lot of mine at the moment is mostly just reading for study. So not that that's negative or anything, I'm really enjoying study. So I mean, a lot of audiobooks, a lot of textbooks and that through psych studies, things like that, like just a lot of work on mindsets. One of the big ones that everyone's jumping on board with now that the MJ documentary's come out on Netflix, Tim Grover, Relentless. Read that if you enjoyed like Jordan's documentary series. Mm-hmm. The guy who writes for Tim Grover is why I started studying psych. Like, it's probably the biggest thing is like what I want to work into is what he does. Mm-hmm. And essentially it's the guy behind the scenes who created the GOAT. Like, yep. Everyone talks about MJ and talks about being the best and how he was the best, but everyone has someone in their corner that helped make them great, and that's what Tim Grover is, and that's what he writes about. The same for Kobe, Kevin Durant, like he works with a lot of guys. So I watch a lot of his stuff, listen to a lot of his stuff. I actually waited for him to come onto the documentary, and like I think the third episode is where he pops up, and that was probably the coolest thing for me. It was like this guy getting his little moment where it was like, cool, MJ's MJ, and everyone knows MJ, but now there's Tim. Mm-hmm. So that's been a cool one for me.
Yeah, it was.
So I've been all over the shop. Hey, so reading wise, I've been doing a whole bunch of like studies, like psych reading and behavioral sciences. Been following along with that. The latest podcast that I really liked was the Ikigai Project, which is explains like the whole concept around Ikigai being a Japanese concept of like your understanding of yourself and how that incorporates across like their perception and traditions and values and stuff, which was really cool. I thought that was really awesome.
Another one that I can't remember if we talked about last time on here, but going on the thing talking about micro changes and micro environments would be Atomic Habits. That'd be, an audiobook, that is amazing. I listened to that through prep. I can't remember if we talked about it last time, but if you need to look at changing routines, habits, getting into better routines, into better habits, that book or audiobook, I listen to the audio because it's easy for cardio.
Yeah.
There's the bee's knees for that.
Yeah, that's a good book. That's a good recommendation. Those have been my like YouTube, far out. I've just been pretty much watching like Modern Warfare, like funny kill clips and stuff like that. It's definitely not helpful advice, but man, if you need 5 minutes off, it's funny.
Awesome. All right, boys, thanks so much for coming on. It's great chatting. Until next time,
dude. Mm. Hey, bro. Can't wait.
Peace out.